Right now, it's time to bring in the dogs.
It is time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine. 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner and chief veterinarian at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello.
Good morning, Jill. Good morning, Marshall.
Good morning.
Well, now that that's out of the way, how about some pleasantries are out of the way. How about some questions?
I'm ready.
All right. Lorna in Canaan. Last month, I gave in to my twin daughter's nagging and got them a hamster, which they named Harry Potter. Harry Potter. Well, not only did Harry Potter turn out to be Harriet Potter, but she's also pregnant. My main concern is that you always hear about hamsters eating their babies. I thought that was guppies. I don't want it to happen in general, but also I'm afraid it would completely freak out the twins. Is there anything I can do to make sure it won't happen?
Hamsters will kill their, mother hamsters will kill their young at times, and it is a stress response. So, and they typically will eat the babies after they're dead.
That's
so
terrible.
Well, it is there's an evolutionary advantage to that if one thinks about it. If the litter is too large, hamsters can have huge litters, up to 10 or 12 babies. And if there's not enough food for all of them, then if you try to spread around food or milk to that many babies, then everybody's going to die. But if you try to just raise a couple, then at least you're going to have potentially some viable outcome there until the babies are old enough to fend for themselves. So the stress response to too much attention, the mom and the babies need time alone. The dad, the father hamster, of course, doesn't sound like they have it, but make sure that there are no other hamsters in the cage. It should be a good size cage, and so not a tiny 1 foot by 1 foot kind of thing, a little bit bigger than that, with a house in it, so that, and lots of bedding material so mom can make a nice nest. So really, if she doesn't feel stressed out, especially with a first litter, so they tend to be more stressed with a first litter, then you're going to have a better outcome. So they need to have quiet. You need to not let children, I wouldn't actually even let children handle them. You can go and peek at them a couple of times a day to make sure that everything's okay, but for the first couple of weeks, just let mom have plenty of fresh food and water and let her do, you know, take care of them. But, you know, taking them away from her, trying to bottle feed, that doesn't make sense. You can't do babies that young. And besides, they're not going to be, they aren't going to be hamsters that are friendly if you were going to try to do that. So the best thing to do is to let her take care of things and definitely be the one to check those babies before the twins do, so that you can circumvent, you can prevent any horrible sights that are going to be underneath the, you know, covering the cage partially with a towel probably is a good idea as well.
All right, and a quick question for you. What would you say to the twins if something terrible happens?
Well, I wouldn't let them see half-eaten babies. I would take the babies out and discard them. But, yeah, I think that you need to explain it, that some of them, I would just say, it depends on how old they are. If they're 2 years old or 3 years old, some of the babies died, and we buried them, you know. Or whatever. I don't know.
I don't
Depends
know.
On,
I'm just
sure
now.
I
think
now.
I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I would tell my 3-year-old that some of the babies died and mom is eating them.
No. I'm sure
she's hungry.
I'm sure. I'm sure you wouldn't. I'm just. I just.
Yeah.
I was just curious.
Not holding or touching the babies. They're just so little and hairless and cute that everybody wants to pick them up, and that's part of the problem. So you really need to leave them alone for a couple of weeks
and
let mom do everything.
Right.
And hope for the best, right?
All right. Katie in Winstead, lately I've noticed that I can hear my cat's tummy gurgling when he's curled up in my lap. I honestly have no idea if it's been happening all this time, and I just never noticed it before. Is it normal for this to happen? He's about 2 years old.
Yes, it is okay. Just like ours do, our stomachs gurgle when we're hungry. As long as your kitty is otherwise fine, so there's no vomiting, no diarrhea, that she's eating well, or he's eating well, and being fed, I'm assuming, a couple of times a day, then that's fine. That gurgly tummy means that you're not overfeeding.
That's good.
So, yeah, cats who have food out all the time will never gurgle because they go and they eat whenever they want.
This is also a good moment. I really hate to go back to such basics, but it's really a good idea that I learned this the hard way to not just leave food out for your cats.
Right. Cats need to have time with an empty stomach and an empty intestine, and that gurgling is telling me that you're doing a good job with that.
All right. And it's funny because when you hear it for the first time, it doesn't mean that you have it, you know, it doesn't mean that it hasn't been happening before.
If there's excessive gurgling, gurgling is called borborygmus. It's a wonderful word.
What is it?
Borborygmus.
Spell it.
B-O-R-B-O-R-Y-G-M-O-U-S.
Oh, that had to be invented by someone who listened to gurgling.
Right. It's a great word, and it can mean that, you know, there's hyperacidity there. But when there's too much acid from either stress or the wrong kind of food, then you're going to have other symptoms as well. So
well,
a little bit of vomiting, poor appetite, et cetera.
Plus, if the cat's comfily lying in, comfily curled up in Katie's lap, you know, that's not indicative of a particularly unhappy situation. That's actually pretty comfortable.
Right. And also stimulates that parasympathetic, that autonomic nervous system, that when you're relaxed and warm and cozy, that your intestines are going to work better.
Okay. All right, Adam in Hartford, we've just had something of a disaster in our household. We have a cat, Bodine, who used to be feral before he got lucky and met us. Suffice it to say, we learned that a cat who's real good at hunting should not be left alone for the weekend with an aquarium. Anyway, the dang cat managed to catch and eat a couple of frogs, a salamander, and a newt. That's not counting the fish. I'm sorry. Do we need to take Bodine to the vet? He seems okay at the moment, but I can't find any info on whether eating amphibians is going to cause problems down the line.
Some of the amphibians have irritant in the skin that will cause vomiting, but sometimes will just cause, a cat will try to eat them and it'll cause some hypersalivation. So it irritates the GI tract. So if he's acting fine, it's probably not the case here. You know, right now, if he's been eating and acting fine and you're seeing stools, then not necessary to go to the vet. If there hasn't been any formed stool, then that may warrant a visit, or if he's not eating well. Otherwise, then I think that he's had a wonderful...
He had fun
this
weekend.
Sounds like he's had a wonderful time. Yeah, party. Yeah. Party while the parents are gone.
Can you say risky business? All right. This is... We're doing all sorts of things. Caleb in Newburgh, my rat Jasper grinds her teeth, which Google tells me is called bruxing, and I guess it's normal. But it also says be careful if your rat is doing it too much. How do I know what is too much?
Rats aren't the only animals that grind their teeth. It's called bruxism, B-R-U-X-I-S-M.
So we're doing the bees. I think people just, maybe veterinary scientists or the inventors of whatever, namers stopped at the beginning of the alphabet with borborygmus.
That could be. Okay. Well, no, there are lots of other great words. I'll have to collect them, and I can just recite them one day.
Okay. It can be a poem.
For instance, pigs in confinement will grind their teeth, too, or pigs that have had that have gastric ulcers will grind their teeth. And if they're fed a food that's too finely ground, then they'll get stomach ulcers and grind their teeth because they're unhappy. So bruxism is, in general, I know that it's well known in rats, but in general, it is a stress sign in other animals and in people. And so I think the more that it's done, you know, I think if I was hearing my rat right from day one, grinding teeth a little bit, and then suddenly you're hearing it constantly, I would be concerned about the environmental stress. So these animals are social, and if he's living by himself, then you are the family and the community, and so you need to behave that way and be spend a lot of time with your rat, with your pet. Rats can become close to other pets in the family, like cats, and that is helpful too. So you want to have an environment that's not too stressful. A small cage is a lot of stress for a rat if they can't move around enough. So they need to get out and move around. They need to have appropriate diet. I'm not an expert on that, but it can be, I'm sure it can be specifically found out.
Right. How would you, because there's so much Google out there, we go through this all the time.
How do you sort that out?
How do you sort out a rat vet?
Yeah. How do you find a rat vet? Well, you want someone who is calling themselves a, exotic animal veterinarian.
Hi, do you do rats?
For that kind of a question. But it is something that most veterinarians, if you're on the Veterinary Information Network, can find out. A rat appropriate diet. This bruxism is associated with aggression and with emotional stress. And my understanding is that it's a protective mechanism as well. So it lowers. There are all kinds of studies out there on these poor rats, and it actually lowers their stress levels to grind their teeth. So some people could say, "Oh, well, that's a good thing," but you don't want an animal to live in a stressful environment their whole lives.
No, and I think that's one of the things just in life and in wellness as we figure out more about reactive or it sounds twee, but proactive. Things have certainly changed since I've had dogs, not rats, about the approach to let's call it just animal. Well, what creates a good environment? What you react to and what you initiate around. So mm-hmm. I would think that anyone who's seen like a rat in a cage on TV doesn't necessarily know the parameters of, you need a big space because they're social and maybe you need, I'm making this up because I don't know anything about.
You need some social interaction.
Right.
For sure. And so having them in a cage just to watch is not enough, and it does stress them out, and chronic stress is a killer. So if you've got a rat who's grinding teeth a lot, then you need to find out what can I do to make changes so that my rat isn't stressed constantly.
And I totally understand the question. I don't even know how you're going to answer it. But what's too much? I mean, what Caleb's asking is how do I know what's too much? Like one.
I think it's progressive.
Okay.
I think I would say if it's progressively grinding more.
Okay.
So I can't tell you exactly how much.
No. I'm not looking for.
I would love
to
see a rat who doesn't grind at all. Wouldn't that be amazing? That would be an amazing life.
So that would be so ideally, what you are looking for is a rat that doesn't grind.
Well, I'm not sure that there is such a thing.
Okay.
We all have stress, and that's their way of dealing with it. So
if I were a rat this morning, oh brother.
You'd be grinding, and then you wouldn't
have
any
teeth
left.
I would be done. It's nubs, nubs.
That's what happens to people. And I heard an interesting quote yesterday talking about the amygdala of the brain. The amygdala is the sort of primordial section of your brain that's responsible for your fight or flight and your stress response. And someone talked about this chronic stress being your amygdala hijacking your frontal lobe.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, that's a great way to put that, because I think that's a great description of people and animals with chronic stress.
Yeah, and the thing is, just as pain has become a thing, stress has become a thing. It's almost a badge. And the problem is that unless you have, once again, tools for managing the stress, you're just living in a constant hijack situation, which is just not pleasant.
Right.
All right, Marion Torrington, what are the long-term health problems, if any, for dogs who have had to have one leg amputated. I have to just interject that Jeremy Sterrett always said there is nothing happier than a three-legged dog.
Well,
always. I don't know why, but it's just, you know, there's a certain joy. When you see them out playing, I have to say that I know what he's talking about.
Yeah, they do. They do quite well, especially if a hind leg is amputated. So dogs use their front legs more heavily than the hind legs as far as weight bearing, and bear about 60 to 65% of the weight on the front legs. So it's much easier if you've got a hind leg amputation to get around. Some dogs do okay. The smaller the dog, the better they do with a front leg amputation, and they tend to use that one leg in the center of the body. So they compensate really well. Hind leg, it'll go again in the center of the body, and so they use it to pivot on and, you know, a tripod kind of a stance. And they do very well. The younger they are, the better they do, the smaller they are, and the lighter they are. So the big issue is overweight, is excessive weight. Because they do not do well with excessive weight. So you have to be very careful to keep them normal weight and keep them fit and get some chiropractic, because that body is twisted and the compensation gets them locked up in certain parts of the body. And that's not just the case with amputees, but also dogs who really don't have the use of, or have very little use of one leg. Which are probably more that I see more of those than dogs who've had an amputation, but the spine, the thoracic spine, gets locked up. In other words, it doesn't move properly. Nothing that you would see necessarily on an X-ray, but something that you can feel if you're a chiropractor.
Right.
Their lumbar spine typically also gets very curved, so you'll see them, because especially that with one leg in the back, that hind leg tends to come down in the middle of the body, and so there's a lot of stress on the lumbar spine. So general body care, like massage, chiropractic.
Would you do anything? I'm thinking about
swimming.
The blind spaniel who was, prior to that, the disabled spaniel, you know, and how... basically, therapy gave her a back end that was so strong that that she's able to use her limb as a pogo stick, you know.
Yeah, so rehabilitation therapy, great. Basically, keeping the rest of the body strong with swimming. Swimming's a great thing, especially with you put a flotation device on, and they can swim with those three legs as if they had four, and help that spine to stretch out, strengthen the abdominal muscles, strengthen the back muscles. So, you know, whatever is affordable.
Right.
That becomes, you kind of have to pick and choose.
That becomes the problem. But the bigger, or not, I shouldn't say problem, but that's very much an issue, because obviously, you know, with kids in college and...
Yeah, and that's not to say that rehab therapy is expensive, but if you're trying to do, you know, chiropractic and acupuncture and rehab simultaneously, it can get a little pricey.
How do you... This has always been a side question of mine, when you are dealing with complementary, which can be so effective that it's absolutely worth considering. Someone I know has a dog with a condition that it isn't easily treated in Western medicine. And so she went and she found herself a nice Chinese herbalist, and the dog is just thriving. But it's if you don't know to do that, if you don't, for example, have a relative who will say, well, why don't you try this, you know, how do you know how to approach it? Is that something that you can ask your regular vet?
I think that your regular vets are more and more in tune to the possibilities of alternative medicine, but you know, it's something that you kind of have to educate yourself about in most cases.
And starting with that, because again, this is so much of there's just so much crap information out there, and you know, you sort of see it even with kids who don't know what they're supposed to eat.
Yeah,
I mean, just basic basic stuff.
There is. You're not going to be able to get an herbal formula off the internet by figuring out it out yourself. Everyone is an individual, and there'll be, you know, I've said this before, but three dogs with the same outward symptoms, and they would be treated with three different Chinese herbal formulas, most likely, because it has to fit the dog. And there's a lot of training and a lot of thinking and a lot of figuring out and experience that goes into that diagnosis and treatment. So going online and getting a single Western herb because it's supposed to help with muscle aches might help in, you know, 1/10 or 1/12 of the dogs, but you're not going to have the synergistic effect of other herbs and protective effect of other herbs in the formula, and it may not help your dog. So you may be going trying, you know, 20 different things and not getting the effect that you want. So
does that hold true with regular? I imagine that holds true with Western medicine. You know, the culture of one pill will do it.
It does. There are some things that work really well. For instance, the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories. You know, and 8 out of 10 animals, you're going to have a response. In maybe 2 out of those 8, you're going to have an adverse response as well. So. And that's not to say that herbs don't have adverse responses. They do at times, but you want to find what is the best for that individual. And in order to do that, you need to use more of a holistic approach to treatment. So looking for a holistic type veterinarian who's going to look at all of that, who does some alternative type therapies, or integrates that with the drugs, with the Western medicine. Herbal formulas can work really well with drugs. But we have the same idea there are certain formulas, for instance, that work really well in cats, in all cats for certain things. And it's the same thing with Western medicine. But if it doesn't fit your profile, you know, if it doesn't fit the cat's profile, I'm not going to use it even as my first line of defense. And it's a bit more difficult with Western medicine because they don't profile drugs that way. Certainly a nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory, if you've got a dog who already vomits off, you know, for very little reason, that you're going to be very careful using those kinds of drugs. But it is complicated.
Right. And it's something that, you know, unless you have a little experience, you it's really worth gaining the experience to know how to be judicious about what your creature needs, because there are so many sort of a la carte things on offer.
Many. And you'll see that there'll be testimonies, and because it may be that 1 out of 100 that it worked, this was the thing that they needed, and they give the testimony that their pet was much, much better. But, you know, that's not great odds. Even 1 out of 20 isn't great odds. If you want to target therapy, the more information that you have, the better that you'll be able to target.
And that being said, each animal is an individual, and it's worth, you know, to the extent of your interest, you know, it's worth pursuing what is possible, but do it with someone who is trained and knows, you know, knows the ramifications of the various, let's call them options.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Is that all the questions you have for me today?
Yes. Do you have a question for me? Just joking.
About the radio station.
Pick a question, any question.
I can't come up with anything quickly.
All right.
Oh,
well.
The weather. The weather now looks cloudy, and I'm wondering if now Marshall yesterday promised that it would be sunny by the afternoon.
It's going to be a nice day today, and then clouds up tomorrow. We get rain tomorrow afternoon and Saturday morning, and then Sunday and Monday and Tuesday look fine.
All right. Thank you for adding that.
This has been Pet Files Ask the Weather Person.
Of course.
Ask the weatherman.
Don't listen to this on the rebroadcast.
Right.
Oh, well. No, a question's a question's and answer's an answer's. This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. Thank you so much, Dr. Cannon.
Thank you.